Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, we're joined by John Ilsley, who was the bassist for Dire Straits all the way through, the only person who was all the way through other than Mark. And it's funny because I was thinking, it was 1978, and I was listening to my radio station in Florida, and the DJ came on and said, well, here's a new one for you. It's from a band called Dire Straits. And after you hear it, could you give me a call and tell me, you know, who did you think this sounded like? And then Sultans of Swing came on, and it was like a shiver. And I had never, ever heard anything like it. But then I thought, oh, I'll call the radio station anyway. So I did, and amazingly, which never happens, I got through. And the DJ goes, so what did you think? Who did it sound like to you? And I went, it didn't sound like anything I've ever heard in my life. And he hung up on me and took the next call. So welcome, John. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
So I guess the first question most people will think about, and the book's been out a bit, but what made you at this time, you know, both of us are of a certain age, what made you at this time decide, let's put this down on paper? And also, I should tell everyone, it's an audio book. It's introduced by Mark Knopfler, who's a great friend of yours. And they also, you should watch Guitar Stories on YouTube, which is your walk down memory lane with him and Mark's best, his favorite six guitars. It's a wonderful show to watch. But and he does a great foreword. But then you have a lovely reading voice, and it was a pleasure reading the book, listening to the book. But what gave rise to the impetus that said, okay, I think I'll write a book about my 20 years, 25 years with Dire Straits?
Well, I hadn't really thought about writing a book, Sam, to be perfectly honest. A couple of years ago, I was doing these shows, quite intimate shows in the UK, just acoustically with a few band members and one of my ex-managers. And we were chatting about the history of Dire Straits, because I thought it would be quite a nice thing to take on the road. You know, play a few songs, have a chat about Wild West End and Salt to Swing, play another song, play Lady Writer, chat about that. And it really went down very well. And I didn't realize at the time that sitting in the audience on one of these gigs was a agent for writers, a writing agent. And it turned out quite a big one. And by complete coincidence, I bumped into her 2 weeks after these gigs we played at a charity event, and she was sitting next to me. This is another coincidence in life. There's lots of them. She turned to me and said, have you thought about writing a book? And I said, well, that's a very strange, I haven't met you before. That's a very strange question to ask me. And she said, well, I'm a writing agent, and I think you should write this down, because I came to watch the show, and it was so interesting to get that background from one of the main sources of the band. And it sort of, she said, I think this will make a really good book. And I went, oh, look, you know, I'm not a writer. I write songs, but, you know, writing a book, that's a different deal altogether. Anyway, she said, well, here's my card. If you change your mind, come and see me and we can chat through it, and we can get somebody to help you to, you know, put it together. So anyway, then we had lockdown. I don't think everybody remembers that, the COVID moment. And so I thought about it, and she rang me two or three times, and I said, I'm still thinking. And in the end, I said, okay, I'll do it. And with the help of a very old friend of mine who was a professional, you know, writer that helped people to put their stories together, you know, we began this process of putting together this document, if you like, and for me, a celebration of my life in this band and everybody else connected to it, who I thought needed some kind of acknowledgement. Apart from Mark, of course, but along with all the other musicians, the caterers, the lorry drivers, the promoters, the guy that hangs from the ceiling with the spotlight, all these people who make the machine work on a band that size. And it took me a long time because I thought I hadn't remembered anything. But when I started to write it down, you know, it just started to flow. And lockdown was the perfect moment because there really wasn't much else to do, to be frank.
Yeah, it actually, you know, at first I thought, well, you know, a lot of people don't remember a lot of things that happened in those times, but it was almost photographic. And like you said, you give credit to pretty much everybody in the crew and all the people you met throughout, including famous celebrities, great yeah. musicians, especially Keith Moon, that one situation. But there's so many questions I could ask you. I would almost, it's almost easier if you could tell me exactly what you want to talk about. But one of the, I guess we should start, maybe we should start in Deptford, or maybe we should start when you saw Mark lying on his back with the guitar over his chest. But why don't you give it a go as to where you'd like to begin with the beginning of the band?
Well, the beginning really was another coincidence. My life seems to be full of them. And I'm a firm believer in you get these moments in life when you have to make a choice about going in one direction or another direction. And in my very early 20s, I had to make a few decisions about the rest of my life, a bit like most people do. There comes a sort of critical time when you have to think, okay, what am I good at? B, what do I want to do? C, do I think I can do it? And, you know, B, do I have the energy to do it for a start? And so I was living in this flat in Deptford, which was basic in the extreme. I won't go into the details, but some people called it a squat, and it really wasn't far off that because A, I didn't have a bean to my name, and I was living on sort of the money from the university, because I went to college when I was 24, which is very late, because I mucked up all my exams when I was younger because I was playing the guitar all the time. And despite the fact that my housemaster used to take them off me every time I played them. But anyway, so that's another story altogether. But so I ended up with this council flat in South London, which is really basic. And I needed somebody to help with the rent, which was at that point in time in dollars was probably about 10 bucks a week. Right. And I couldn't afford it and drink beer. So I had to get a mate to come and join me in this council flat. And a friend of a friend said, this chap was a local social worker, needs a place. And that was David Knopfler. And David arrived carrying a guitar. And I thought, I think we might get on, he and I, which we did, and became a great friend. And then, of course, Mark turned up, you know, a few weeks later. And we just became connected quite quickly, actually. I just thought to myself, I've got a feeling I'm going to know this chap for a long time. And I didn't realize it was going to be 50 odd years.
That's what we were talking about before.
So that's the bare bones of how it all got together. A series of coincidences. I packed in my job, went to university, moved into the council flat, which was a big move to stop a very successful job and go to university again and go back to being a student. And then I met the people that were going to make my life come together, and theirs, of course.
Yeah, one of the things I thought of when I listened to you was that, you know, my father always said, you make your own luck. And I thought, yeah, yes, you're right. Life is
exactly
chance.
Right.
But
exactly
if you're laying on the floor, an opportunity knocks at your door and you're too lazy to get up and answer the door, you're not going to be in dire straits.
Yeah. Well, that's it, you see. I mean, you know, some people take the safe road, but everybody knows me, I don't really ever take that road. I always take something that's going to be a little chancy.
And then your parents are not exactly pleased with those chances.
Oh my God, no, they were slightly panicking because, you know, it was always like, I hate to use the expression black sheep of the family, but I really wasn't, I don't think I was the favorite child, or they'll probably deny that, but there were four of us, and I think I was the sort of a bit of an afterthought, but we better not go into that one. But anyway, so, you know, you're quite right. You make your own I don't, you make your own life. I wouldn't call it luck, but you make your own way in life. And sometimes it might be a mistake and you just have to go, okay, that didn't work, but I'm still going to, you know, take the odd chance in order to move forward.
Yeah. I was just thinking when you're talking about black sheep, two things. One, how everyone in the book you treat so kindly, even the situation between David and Mark, there's not a bad word you say about anything that happened there. But I was thinking about how nice your brother was to you, especially the fact that he actually made a bass guitar for you.
Yeah, extraordinary, isn't it? I wish I'd had that thing still, but it got lost in the move from one place to another. I can't remember really. But yes, I mean, I didn't really see myself as being a bass player, to be honest. I wanted, like everybody else, wanted to be a guitar player. But I've really, as you can see, I've got the hands of a bass player. So as it turns out, and as soon as I started playing it, I thought, this is me. Simple as. I didn't have to look any further. This was the way that I was going to interpret music. So I think when I hear music, the first thing I listen to actually is the bass and see if that's working properly.
The other thing for people of a certain age like us is, you know, every reference, because you were right, you and I are in the same wheelhouse. I mean, when you talk about Joe Cocker and then Jeff Beck and then even Family, which is Rick Gretsch on bass, and then he was in Blind Faith. I saw Blind Faith on their only tour of the United States. And then the White Album, and then Richard Thompson, who played, my brother saw him in Royal Albert Hall for his 70th birthday. He's older than us. And then Ian Drury and the Blockheads. Who would think that I would hear that again and hit me with your rhythm stick? But that was one of the most fun part of the books, was all the people that you revere are the same ones I did too.
Yes. There's just sort of fairly major moments, I think, that are created by certain people, by chance or by, intention. We don't know, but it doesn't really matter. The fact of the matter is there are certain people who move you and touch you in a way that somebody else doesn't touch you. And that goes for reading a book, looking at a painting, listening to music. You know, they're all in the same. There's a sort of an emotional element, which I find very, very important in all aspects of my artistic life, if you like, you know, with painting and with music and with theatre and with reading a book. You know, in some books, I just start them and after about 15 pages, they go, this is just not for me. And other things just grab me and I'm off, you know, and I just run with it. And I think that's probably the same for a lot of people. But, you know, you're right. These people, I mean, Richard Thompson, you know, Rick Gretsch, you know, Stevie Winwood, I grew up with all this lot, and, you know, they're only about 2 or 3 years older than me. My God, they started young.
Stevie Winwood, yeah.
And I've followed Eric, you know, Clapton all his life pretty much, and dear Jeff and Jeff Beck and people like that. And, you know, going to see the very first group, you know, the Faces was called, you know, with Ronnie Wood on bass and Rod Stewart singing, and fantastic moments.
Yeah, really, like Ichiku Park. It's funny because Mark, without ego, when people talk to him, he always says the reason why he still plays these songs, and you do too, and my son listens to those, you singing Sultans of Swing, is because Mark says these songs are milestones in people's lives. Yeah, and that's why he still thinks he, kind of, not a duty, but he feels like it's as you say, he feels it's a gift from the people rather than him giving to them.
Yes, he's absolutely right. I mean, you know, if you manage to write something which somebody else likes, even if it's one person or a million people, you've kind of achieved something. If it's a million people, obviously that's an absolute bonus. Doesn't happen very often. And I don't really think that when Sultans of Swing was written, just as an example, I don't think that was, we weren't going, oh, this is going to be a hit. We had no idea at all. And in fact, actually, I'll tell you a little story. I can't remember whether I put this in the book or not. But when it first came out in the UK, Sultans, you know, we had a little bit of a following in the clubs and the pubs and such like. But that was about all. And it was sent to the BBC. And the BBC said, oh, we can't play this. There's too many words in it. And so I only found this out later. And so they didn't play it. And so that's why it was a hit in America before it was a hit, before it was in England. And it was a hit almost all the way around the world. And then the BBC, God bless them, you know, in their stuffy, you know, 1970s, you know, moments, decided to play it. And of course it became a hit. And with all those words in it as well, you know.
Well, the great story is how you guys came back to go to the pub. And you didn't know that you were popular, but everyone started applauding as you walked into the pub. And you had no idea.
That was pretty weird. Well, we just gave the tape to Charlie Gillett because I kind of knew him through a record shop that I'd started. And Charlie just said, I'll listen to it. He didn't say he was going to play it. That's for certain. He said, I'll listen to it and I'll give you a call. And then we said, oh, great. Thanks, Charlie. And walked away. And then that was on the Thursday. On a Sunday morning on his radio show, he played it. And we were... I think Mark and I were shifting some furniture for some friends to make some money, you know. And then we went in the pub that night, as you say, and everybody went, you're on the bloody radio. I mean, what are you talking about?
Yeah, and the thing about it is that, yes, he was a great person for you. And as you said, all about so lovely and so kind and so gracious. But then again, all these chance moments, the fact that your aunt died and you got 500 quid. That's it. I mean, but for that, you wouldn't have been able to make your demo tape.
Well, no, the fact of the matter is, and I tell you what, 500 quid was a lot of money there because we were literally not living on bread and water, but, you know, one meal a day and a couple of pints, that's about all we could afford. And so that 500 quid was a considerable amount of money. If you think about it, in 1976 or something, 77, you know, that would be probably 5,000 quid now. And that money, as you rightly say, was used to make a demo tape. And, you know, some people say that version of Sultans is on that demo tape is still the best one. I don't know. I've got no real kind of opinions about it, you know, but because there's several versions of that now. But the thing is, Charlie Gillett spotted that song, which we didn't really. You know, we said it's a good song and it felt good to play. But, you know, we had no idea. We've never been very good at singles, actually. That's all I can say. We don't know. We never know what's going to sort of jump out at people. We'd rather let the record companies decide on what they wanted to play because they kind of know what the public want, apparently.
Well, if you think about it, think of Telegraph Road. Who would think that anyone would even accept it? It starts so slow. And even though the middle, the crescendo, if you will, is amazing, it's a very long song, a long format, and it starts so softly that you wouldn't think it would be such a wonderful, wonderful song.
Well, the thing about Mark's writing, Sam, is the fact that he's able to create an atmosphere, create a story, which... really has a strong foundation to it. You know, he was an English teacher, so he's got a very, very good use of language, obviously, but also he's very observant. And I think that's the essence of a good songwriter, is seeing something and being able to put it down so somebody else gets it. And Telegraph Road, you know, was a momentous bit of writing and also a momentous bit of playing and recording. It was quite an epic moment as well, because it's, as you say, it's 14 minutes long, and when you're playing it live, you don't even think about it because it's just like two songs joined together. But when you're in the studio and you've got to keep that energy at a certain value and level for 14 minutes, it's pretty difficult.
Oh, that's a good jumping off point for not only the studio in the Bahamas, but also the fact we should talk about the evolution of the band and David, you know, how you start out, these four guys, and all of a sudden you're adding keyboards, you're adding computers, and the first band to do that, the first band to have a compact disc that sold a million copies.
Yeah, well, I think we just happened to be there when the technology was being developed, and Well, at the time, of course, it was a remarkable moment. The record company was probably rubbing their hands in glee, the fact that everybody had bought the cassettes and the LP, and now they had to buy the cassette, the CD as well. So, I mean, there was a bit of a sort of financial element to it. But no, I mean, CDs really transformed the way people listen to music for a while, in the same way that Spotify's done the same thing now, transform music in a certain kind of way beyond what we could have even dreamt of. But I mean, that was just we just happened to be there at that moment. The same with MTV was just starting. It was in America, I think, in 84, but it didn't come to the UK until 85, which has just coincided with, you know, the fact that we had a song called Money for Nothing on there, which was really about, you know, MTV.
There was a story Mark told about being in an appliance store and listening to some lorry driver, and he just wrote down.
He bought a house in New York at some point before that, and he needed to get some TVs and fridges and washing machines for this. I just have this picture in my mind of Mark going into a white goods store and buying a washing machine. I think I still find that image very, very funny. But while he was there, of course, he heard all the blokes looking at the TV. And I don't know who was on the screen. I think it might have been Michael Jackson or something. I'm not exactly sure. And he just listened to these blokes and just wrote down an awful lot of what they were saying and then added a whole lot of stuff of his own. And hey, presto, you've got a fairly extraordinary observation of what was going on at that moment in music. And, you know, in the way that music was being spread around the world by television and by the digital revolution, if you like.
Yeah, and I guess I got off topic. I think for people who don't even know, why can you give us a thumbnail sketch of the roster of musicians throughout the years and the addition of other sounds?
Ooh, gosh. Well, I mean, of course, as you rightly say, we were a four-piece, really. And but when we were making movies, you know, obviously there was some keyboards was being, you know, being introduced into a lot of the songs. And Shelly Yackas and Jimmy Iovine had been playing with Roy Buttan from the E Street Band with Bruce Springsteen. And, you know, they just happened to say, well, you know, Roy Buttan will be able to handle this very nicely. And of course he could handle it very nicely. So Roy came in and played, you know, a lot of keyboards on Making Movies, which, of course, it was for us, it was a big jump away from, you know, the first album and Communique, which was basically a four-piece, just playing the songs. I think there was a couple of keyboard chords on Communique, but not much more than that, which Barry Beckett put down. But so Roy got introduced into that. And then, of course, on things like... by that time, then we had Alan Clark join the band as a member, you know, for the tour, the Making Movies tour. And that's he and Mark worked through Telegraph Road a lot before it even came into the band's arena of energy. And so Alan joined, and then there was, oh, my goodness, let me think, Making Movies, Telegraph Road. I think we had a few other people on that. Gosh, I can't remember now. This is where I have to start going back through all the details on the album sleeve.
Yeah. Right now, I probably remember the book better than you do.
You probably do, despite the fact that I've talked about it quite a lot over the years. But, you know, and Brothers in Arms, of course, you know, it was the introduction of saxophone and percussionists and such like. And so, you know, a lot of, I think Manu Katché played with us on that, and the Brecker Boys, you know. So, you know, suddenly we were working with the very best musicians in the world, and it was a real pleasure to have them come in and work with us, which, you know, this simple little rock and roll band from you know, South London, which obviously we made a bit of progression by the time they came to some Brothers in Arms. But yes, it's, I mean, it's just wonderful to be able to have great people playing with you. I mean, like, you know, Jake Beccaro, you know, on Every Street album, for me as a bass player, yeah, to play with him was just sheer joy. I mean, he did the whole record in 3 days. It was quite remarkable the way he worked. Just wonderful. Wonderful. Very blessed with all that.
One thing that I didn't understand was, even after you got popular, you told stories about how after the concert, you ended up with a, as you would say, a tenner or a fiver. But it seemed like you were already popular. So why would you even subject yourself to that? Or did you? Am I getting it wrong?
No, that was the reality. I mean, you did get, when you toured in the UK, when, you know, for the first couple of years, I mean, you go and play the marquee club in front of, I think one night we played to 1,000 people, which was 400 people over the required amount of people that were supposed to be there, and we got paid £80, and the PA cost us £55. So I mean, we literally ended up with £15 between all of us, between the four of us. I mean, and that was, you know, and a pint of beer. I mean, it was really, it was absolute exploitation on a massive scale. If you wanted to play in these places, they said, yeah, you can play, but you're only getting £50, you know, or £100 or whatever. Well, by the time you've paid your roadie and the guy that does the sound and you've rented the PA, you've got nothing left. And that went on for quite a while. It was only really when we did the, you know, when we started touring with the Communique album, that there was actually some decent money in the pot. And then we could actually, you know, buy a car with four wheels on it. Now I'm exaggerating, of course. Anyway.
When we were talking about music and art, it reminds me of the first chapter of your book, which is very lyrical, evocative, and almost like a painting, that first chapter. Talk about that when you were like, who was the band that was lying by the pool? I should know. Ozark
Mountain Daredevils.
Daredevils. Yeah. Yeah. And you talk about that. And then you talk later at the same place where you meet Bob Dylan. And this is the guy who you've been revering. And then all of a sudden, Mark's working with him. But talk about that first chapter when you're out on the balcony and Mark comes out and says, you know, here we are.
Well, I think that, you know, it was that first American tour. We were still, you know, we really didn't have enough. I think we got a little bit of support from the record company in America, but we had three roadies. And of course, by the time we got to America, the single was number four or something, and the album was number two in the charts. And we were going, oh my God, this is ridiculous. And every single city we drove into, it was either Souls of Swing, Roxanne, or Breakfast in America. I remember that. So a little bit of a competition going on there. And so we suddenly realized that the band was absolutely becoming huge in America. And we were playing in these small clubs. And all the promoters said, no, we've got to move you into a big place, bigger places, you know, 2,000-3,000 people. And we said, no. All these tickets are sold out. We're going to do this tour and we'll come back later. And so the vibe in these, like the Bottom Line and the Roxy and places like that, was amazing. And the one you're talking about in LA was the Roxy, of course, which is world famous. Everybody's played there. And of course, the band, by the time we got to the Roxy was, you know, was literally being played everywhere. So it was what you call a very hot ticket, I think, in America, to say the very least. So there was quite a lot of celebrity eyeballing going on by not just the audience, by also the band saying, my God, there's Stevie Nicks wandering out. And then, oh, there's, you know, there's Rod Stewart. And it was like, oh my God. And we're still a little four piece from this flat in Deptford. So it was quite a moment. And then Bob came up to us in the bar upstairs and you know, said, you know, that was great, guys. You know, you've got some kind of sound there. I think that's what he said. And he said, do you want to come back to the hotel and I'll play you some songs? Well, I mean, that was, I don't know what you say to Bob when he says, do you want to come back to the hotel and drink some whiskey and listen to some songs? We went, yeah, all right. Okay, we'll do that. And that was quite a moment. I mean, it was quite extraordinary. And as I say in the book, those songs have never seen the light of day. They were all brilliant. And he's probably dumped them the next day and wrote some more. I don't know. And then, of course, he and Mark got on very well and went on to work together quite a bit and, you know, became sort of quite friendly, I think.
It was funny the way you talked about Rod Stewart, like just turning around at the bar and saying, "Hey, nice, good job."
Do you want a beer? And then the next time I played with him was at one of these, you know, those big charity concerts in London, and he was one of the people who you know was playing with us. So yeah,
and then the first one, which and you portray this well, because you say it was tragic in a way, was Keith Moon. So tell that story.
Yeah. Well, Keith was, you know, as we know, was quite excessive in his behaviour on many, many occasions. And he turned up at the Marquee. I think we were doing what we call a small residency. We were playing every Wednesday for about a month there. And by the last time, the last Wednesday we were there, as I say, we had over 1,000 people in the Marquee Club, which really should have held about 500. It was so hot, we almost passed out. And anyway, we went back to the dressing room, which was probably about the size of somebody's normal bathroom, if you like, and much worse than somebody's normal bathroom. And Keith came in with his minder, and immediately walked in and fell over, of course. And then his minder picked him up, and he said, you know, that was great, guys. That was great, and fell over again. So this happened about sort of four or five times. In the end, he had to be just taken out because he was sadly too worse for wear. Thank God he had somebody who could pick him up and take him home. And then a few weeks later, he was sadly dead. Tragic. I mean, you think about it, you think, oh, there for the grace of God, just back off a bit, and then you would have survived and probably become vaguely sensible at some particular point and now be talking to you guys and, you know, about his life. And you think, oh, what a waste. And that's what I can't stand about it. This is why I hate narcotics, because they're unpredictable, you know, and booze and all the rest. Too much of anything just, you know, is no good, basically.
Well, there's two aspects of your career that weren't chance. Well, one was you guys had some maturity, because you were already like kind of almost like a businessman, and Mark was a teacher and a journalist. So, and you started late, but later than most people, in your mid to late 20s, and also that you never did drugs. Well, I mean, you did some, everyone did, but you weren't addictive personalities.
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to get into all that sort of just general sort of rock and roll lifestyle stuff, because I've read so many books where it just goes on and on about groupies and drug abuse and drinking too much and all this. So, yeah, okay. You know, that's what happens in rock and roll bands. I mean, let's just be honest about it. And so I thought, I'd read enough about all that with other people. And I thought, no, there's just no point in doing that. But, we weren't saints, I can assure you. And we had a good time, but in our own way. I mean, you know, because my way of thinking about it, and the same with Mark, and I think this is why we made a good pairing, was because we figured that everybody who was coming to see us, certainly towards the end, and these were big concerts, had made a fantastic effort to get to see you. They'd spent a lot of money getting there. It was a nightmare parking. And these big stadiums are difficult to get into, difficult to get out of. So you kind of owe it to the audience to arrive on stage, at least, you know, pretty much sober, and play your gig, you know, roughly on time for two and a half hours. That's what they're there for. You don't make them wait for an hour and a half, you know, because you haven't got the balance of drugs right. I mean, it's like, just, you know, go and do something else. I mean, just treat your public actually with respect, because they're the reason why you're up there having a very nice time. And so there was just a few rules in the band. It's not terribly boring, but there was just, you know, I say to the guys, look, you can do what you like after the show, but I want you here at 8 o'clock, you know, tomorrow night, stone cold sober.
And yeah, then, you were always on time. And the other thing that you did, which I don't know, I know the way you meant it, and other people go, "Whoa, it wasn't like that." But you talk about the war, and your dad, and you talk about being, you know, being away from home for a year and your wife and your kid at home. And then the other thing is, you know, you got up there sometimes being really sick and turning and vomiting into a bucket. And the one time you got hurt and just stood up and kept on going, even though you were bleeding.
Yeah. Yeah, slightly insane. But, you know,
but very honorable.
The only time, actually, if I'm right in thinking, that a concert was cancelled was, I think it was in Luxembourg, when the promoter tried to save some money on staging, and we got a call from the crew before we left the hotel to go to the gig to say, "You can't do this gig. The stage is collapsing. It's very dangerous for the audience. The PA on it is too heavy, which they put on there. The stage isn't capable of holding. You've got to cancel this gig." That was the only time that we cancelled. If you're ill, you play. If you've got the flu, you play. If you're sick, you play. Simple as. If you get cut, you play. You know.
You did. The other thing you did, which I was also thinking, why would they do that? You played in some really dangerous places where you were. Why would you even play there? Did you know that it was going to be as bad as it was?
What are you talking? Which places are you talking about?
You're talking about the one with the Hells Angels in front of it, the couple that didn't have any security at all, the one where you were surrounded and you really didn't have a place, a curtain. And then it was in communist countries where they were rushing the stage. And
There were
several of them, John.
Yeah. Well, the Hell's Angels thing was the Paradiso in Amsterdam, and we didn't know that they were we didn't know they were the security until we actually got there. And this was in the it's a 79, I think it was, and the promoter said, "Tonight the Hell's Angels are doing the security on the stage." And it was like, okay. Not only did they do the security on the stage, they actually sat on the stage with us and watched. And then came backstage and drank all our beer. But they were nice guys. They were just making a point. You know, we're basically in charge, and you don't argue with those guys, really. You know, but I mean, yeah, we did have some moments which were pretty edgy, I must say. The ones in Italy, I got ticked off by somebody actually wrote to me about the fact that I was, you know, having a go at the state of security in Italy. And I thought, you know, you're sort of undermining the Italian, you know, this way of life. And I just thought, no, I'm not. I'm just telling you the way it is. I didn't make that up, you know.
It's hard. Somebody, you can't do it. You're not allowed to sort of say that
was a nightmare. Well, it was a bloody nightmare. You know, I mean, it was dangerous. And,
you didn't have they didn't have any security.
No.
And the only security they had was the guys that took off their jobs and got in trouble later, but they were in uniform. But they weren't secure.
No, the police just walked away. They said, "It's your problem." You know, I mean, that was it's the one in Milan where we'd already sold out something like 30,000 tickets it was sort of like a big sort of mini arena in the middle of Milan, held about 30,000 people. And there was another 30,000 people outside. And the police said, "You have to open the doors." And we said, "We can't open the doors. Where are they going to go? It's already full. And they said, "The 30,000 people outside are causing a problem in the street. It's your problem." And we said, How is it our problem? And the police just walked away and ordered the gates open. So another 30,000 people came in. It was carnage. Absolute carnage.
Scared the hell out of me.
It was hell.
But two countries that were the opposite. One, which I didn't know, is that the Netherlands is kind of a test ground for British groups. And the other one, and we can get into art, is Australia and how you fell in love with it. And that's where you began to get your interest in art. Fascination with it.
I mean, I've got a big soft spot for Australia, I have to say, and the Australians were very very keen on the band, to say the least. So we did a lot of concerts down there and in New Zealand.
And you're right about.
Go on.
I was going to say some of your shows, like they wouldn't do it today, but you played like 13 nights in a row.
I think actually the Sydney Entertainment Centre, we played 22 nights there.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And we could have played another 22. But it was, you know, it was a bit like going to work, clocking on and clocking off, you know, with one of those ticket machines. But it was great fun. And we stayed at a nice hotel in Sydney and we went to the beach during the day and it was all very civilized. And then just did a concert in the evening. I mean, it was just like, we'll see you at the, we'll see you backstage in a couple of hours. And off we went.
That was where you met Brett. That's where you met Brett. And
yes, Brett Whiteley. Yes, I mean, I don't know whether he's known in the States, but I think he probably is. He did spend some time there. He lived in the Chelsea Hotel in New York for a while. Now, a remarkable character, one of those rare individuals that you will never meet the like of again. I mean, and he inspired me really to, you know, take another look at actually getting involved personally in art, not just buying it, but actually doing it. And he was a great inspiration to me, actually.
Yeah, and you portray his personality almost like a split personality and following the band. And after, because I was so interested in him, I started looking at his art, and his self-portraits are like haunting.
Oh yeah, no. Well, he was a haunted man. I mean, he believed that an artist should really push himself to the absolute extreme in order to achieve some kind of enlightenment. And of course, he pushed himself once too many times to the extreme and overdosed. And he was only 58, I think. Yeah, I really miss him. And there's so many friends I've got now who would have loved to introduce him to, because he was an incredible character. He was an extraordinary man and a wonderful artist. I mean, really wonderful. I mean, I've never failed to, if I show some people his work, they just go, my God, I did never heard of this guy.
I know, but that's exactly what happened to me. And yeah. But the interesting thing you say, almost as an aside in the book, is that you think, and I think it's true, like whether it's Franz Kafka or Tennessee Williams, you can't not necessarily be happy as an artist. It comes from somewhere in that.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to dig pretty deep in order to find something interesting to say or to make or to paint or whatever. I mean, and sometimes, you know, when you're getting into a sense of despair, this is seen as being a shortcut. I'm not convinced about that, to be perfectly honest. I mean, because having worked with somebody who's a consummate songwriter, if he's got demons, he's kept them pretty far away from being recognized. He's, you know, being a writer, being an artist is an observation, as I said earlier. Some people just have the ability to be able to observe the world and, you know, rise above it in a sense. I think Anais Nin, the writer, she said the role of the artist is to sort of rise above everything and look down on it and reinterpret it so people can see it in a different kind of way and make it more meaningful. And I think that's the great thing about storytelling, whether you're an artist or a writer, or, well, artist covers all of that, of course. So let's talk about artist. And so it's a form of communication which some people have the ability to do and other people are not interested in doing it or don't feel they can do it. They say that everybody's got at least one book in them. I think I've done mine now, so I'm not going to do another one.
It seemed like, you know, when you look back at it, whether it's you looking back or me, that you and Mark were fairly level-headed people. Maybe Mark compartmentalized stuff, but he was always low-key. And you would say, like, even if there was an emergent situation, he would just go, okay, whatever. I think that's what kept the band I would say that's what kept the band together. Well, it was, because it was just the two of you.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, you need, in some ways, if you're a solo artist, if you like, it's more difficult. I think if you've got somebody else with you who understands what the deal is, and that's really a part, it's a kind of friendship, but it's also an understanding of the role that people play in bands, how to keep them together. And sometimes how they break apart as well, of course. But, you know, that's obvious. But, you know, if you look at a lot of successful bands, it's not just one person. You know, Jagger and Richard, for instance, Lennon, McCartney. Oh, I don't know. Let me think. Look at Fleetwood Mac. All those people were integral parts of it. You know, OK, it was a bit messy on occasions, but, you know, C'est la vie. And, you know, you're stronger together. Two strong people are bigger than two people. They're sort of like three or four even, because if you're like-minded and you see the way that we should be going, and you know, I was better at some things than Mark. You know, I was quite good at organizing things in the early days. And, you know, I let him get on with what he did and, you know, recognized his abilities and celebrated them, as you know. But so it's a teamwork, really. I mean, it's like you can't win a football match just with a center forward, you know.
Right. Well, exactly. And that's and you also explained very well how the bass and the drum is kind of like the foundation.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't exist without that. And
no, you take that out. You take the bass out of a track, it goes, something's happened here. That's not good.
But
I still love playing the bass. I mean,
yeah, I was going to ask you. Music. Talk a little bit about your music now, and because you have an interesting band from time to time, which is completely different than it was.
Yeah. Well, not many people know this, but I've had 8 solo albums out now. My 8th one came out last year, and so I'm pretty much sort of putting ideas down most of the time. Sometimes quicker than others, sometimes nothing happens at all, but so I have to keep the iPhone handy. But so I'm constantly thinking about things, of ways of maybe writing something interesting, and sometimes I don't really know, I have no idea how it all comes together, really. I really don't, but I love the excitement of putting ideas together and making them work. And I do love recording, and I love playing live. So, you know, over the years, 8 solo albums, you know, probably 60, 70 songs or something like that I've written. And, you know, I've been very happy with the response it's had. I mean, this last record actually has had the biggest response of all of them. I don't quite know why, but maybe it's just, you know, coming of age. I don't know. But
yeah, it's amazing.
I love it. I mean, I'm doing some festivals, some small festivals in this country this year. I did one on Saturday. Great, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 people. Lovely, great audience, great band, great sound. There's nothing not to like, really.
And yeah, well, you and I were talking before we began about how both of us were just 18. And I honestly feel that way. But, you know, who would have thought that you would never, ever, even at the, like Mick Jagger saying, I'm not going to be singing Satisfaction when I'm 30. And there he's 80 on another tour. But yeah, it's amazing that you can still do it and do it well, and your voice is still in really good shape, which is surprising. Amazing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think nobody really thought that anybody would be playing rock and roll beyond the age of 40. You know, it's just, it was seen as being a really young man's game. And who would be interested in anybody over 40 on a stage? But in fact, actually, you know, there's an awful lot of people now who can continue to play right to the very end. I mean, which is fantastic. I mean, Jeff Beck was literally playing a couple of days before he sadly died, and Robbie Robertson, and, you know, Tina Turner. I mean, we were all these people that we've touched in our lives, and, you know, and they've all, their contribution to the world of music is fantastic and still going on. I mean, the Stones still please a lot of people, you know. They got quite good at it now. They know what they're doing now, I think.
Yeah, I know. I remember seeing them on the Steel Wheels tour and thinking, wow, they're really old. And now I think, wow, they were so young then.
Yeah, that was 20 years ago, I
At
think.
least, probably, it's probably longer than that, John. It's probably 30 years ago.
Only thing that I find, you know, I mean, I did a festival 2 or 3 weeks ago, and it was 2.25 hours, and it was full on. It was a very hot day, and you know, I went back to the dressing room off the stage after one encore, and I sat down and thought, Jesus Christ, that was exhausting. And then, you know, my PA, my security guy came in and he said, you've got to go back on again. I said, I can't. I've had it, man. I've had it. And he said, just drink a bit of this vodka and get back on there. So, but you know, it's lovely and it's just fantastic. You know, it's the only game in town really for me right now is to do some live gigs. I've got a great band. I've got a lovely bunch of guys and a girl. Got a girl singing.
Oh yeah, I saw her singing.
Yeah, she's a great singer.
Well, anyway, yes. Yeah, I guess to conclude, that's a good time to wind down. Is that you're still not wound down? You're still going. Your book is at my bookstore, and you still have your music. And so thank you so much for doing this today. It was a pleasure talking to you and meeting you.
Well, thank you very much. I always like to have a chat with people who love music.
Yeah, it really, the book really made me happy. I read it, listened to it in one sitting. And just, there are so many memories. It's just like you and Mark say that you've touched so many lives. So I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, no, well, we were very fortunate in that respect, you know.
Yeah, we all were.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Might see you again sometime.
I would love to.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.